Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
What's up, though?
All right, we got the quick intro, which means this time, at the very least, we have a guest. We are joined by Assistant General Manager of the Dallas Mavericks, Matt Riccardi. Matt, how are you?
I'm doing wonderful, guys. Nikias, Steve, thanks for having me on.
Oh, we appreciate you taking the time. This is going to be a fun one. Nice change of pace as we're in the W season, but couldn't pass up on this opportunity. Matt, 13 years with the Brooklyn Nets, currently member of the Dallas Mavericks. More broadly, when did you know that you wanted to work in basketball?
Ooh, you know what? I think at a younger age, probably middle school, I thought basketball was my thing. Now I'm 5'7", so I knew I was never going to play anything besides, a little Division III action there. So afterwards, really got into it. But I knew basketball was the passion, was my one true love, and just wanted to try to stay involved with it any way I could at an early age. I was lucky enough to follow through with it.
Oh, got you. I guess with that, was there a particular area of basketball that you gravitated to?
Definitely wanted to coach. When I was early on in my life, I wanted to coach. Seeing the kind of tangible impact you could make on a day-to-day basis, the short-term impact of helping guys. I think even when I was playing, if you talk to any of my coaches, high school, college, I was kind of a player coach, had to play with my brain because I wasn't very good, and was constantly thinking of different ways of how I could improve myself or how I could help the team. So I always wanted to get into coaching. And as I got further and further involved in it, I realized the front office side was probably better suited to my speed and to my skill set. But coaching after playing, transitioned into coaching being my passion.
This is interesting to me because, like, normally you hear folks say they want to get into coaching or people get into coaching. It's generally someone else coming to them saying, I think you're going to end up doing this. Did you have a coach that kind of poured into you in that regard?
I did. I think quite a few of them kept me on the roster just for that reason. But either that, I was helping boost the GPA a little bit. But I did. I had a few coaches that told me, "Hey, I think you'd be good at this. This is an avenue you want to go down." And at that time, when I was playing, whether in high school, we had a really good high school team out here in Dallas, Texas, and I think eight guys ended up playing college ball. Myself, I played Division III, and my high school coach was a big part of that. And then my college coach as well, they were pushing me, hey, this might be something you want to try out down the road. Really appreciate all the things you're bringing to the table. So it was coaching. And then when I finally broke through and finally got to the NBA, it was basketball operations internship. And once I got there, the dynamics were a little different. And some people pushed me in the other direction, said you might be better suited going on the front office end using your business degrees than, trying to be a 5'7 dude that played Division III basketball, trying to coach and get these guys to respect you in that element. So luckily I got to learn from guys like Steve and people way smarter than me and got to be around it at a high level and kind of transitioned over into that management kind of sphere.
Yes, Steve, your response.
Well, I was going to get there. I was trying to get a build up. So obviously, since Matt was with the Nets forever and ever and ever, I also was there for a grand total of 2 years, but had an amazing time with Matt while there. I guess the number one thing I would ask as we build up, because it's something that people always ask me, like, how do you get your foot in the door? How did you make it happen? How did you make it work? And so we intro you as assistant GM of the Mavs, but man, you put a lot of work in to get to that point. And you wore a lot of different hats. I think, like, what you've done has always been incredible, and I have so much respect for it. How would you answer that question? How did you get your foot in the door?
Great question. And I think a lot of people's stories are similar, in terms of the early days of breaking in and getting there and sleeping at the office and all the things that we all had to do when we were – coming up in this industry. But I was playing Division III and I wanted to try it at the highest level. And I kept telling myself, if I can get to the NBA, I want to see what that's about. I want to learn from them and maybe I'll fail miserably and go do something else or come back to my high school and be an assistant coach, anything. I wanted to stay in basketball, but I wanted to try to get to the highest level. So the end of my junior year, the end of my senior year, the end of my grad school year, I was cover letters, resumes. I was hitting all the wrong people, guys, like literally all the wrong people. Didn't know what I was doing. I don't think LinkedIn existed, but whatever I was doing, it was wrong. I was sending letters to people that would never read them and just was missing my mark because I didn't have a connection. So I like to joke around and tell people that I got rejected 89 times in the NBA. And because every team rejected me 3 times and the Nets rejected me twice. Mm. So I'm the third time with the Nets. Bobby Marks, who, you know, now is a very famous man in our industry and an awesome, awesome, awesome individual and still a great friend of mine. It was my third time trying with the Nets and he was finally like, man, all right, come on. Come on, we'll take you. We'll take you, man. We'll take you, kid. We're willing to drive up from Texas to New Jersey and take this unpaid internship. Come on. We're the worst team in the league, but I'm sure you'll have a good experience. And at the time they were, and I loved it. I loved every second of it. But Steve, to your point, I got lucky. You know, I really did. But when I was able to get my foot in the door, and this is a thing that I think the people now coming into the league suffer from, is they don't get a chance to prove themselves. There's too many people. There is, every organization has, you know, 25 people in the front office. When you were there with the Nets, when I first started, there was 5 people in the front office. It's like, you got to do everything. I was an intern, but I had 17 jobs. And it was amazing because if you were good and if you worked hard and you could prove yourself, then people are like, oh, this guy's willing to grind it out. Now it's like, hey, you're an intern, stay in this lane, do this. If you do this well, maybe something will happen for you. So you get less of a chance to prove yourself. So long-winded way to answer your question, but something that happened to me early on that I do think is important for people was every other year I had a different job and a different responsibility. And I kept thinking, man, Billy King was the GM at the time and Bobby Marks was assistant GM. I'm like, you guys are killing me. I just got good at this one and you're moving me to this one. And I'm like, can I just keep going here? But and the jobs were very random. And I was like the utility guy. Like Steve mentioned, I did a bunch of different jobs, whatever they needed me to do. And I didn't realize it at the time. And now I do, that experience made me so much more well-rounded and allowed me to be a better leader and a better manager today because I have that level of empathy for the different positions, for all the different jobs that I went through, you know, during my time.
I love that. And now brain's turning a little bit. I wonder with, as you said, front office sizes are growing and things like that. If you're someone that's trying to break in, I guess what is the best way of going about there? Because there's no perfect answer to that. But I guess to your point about being comfortable in a role and being asked to expand and being able to do a little bit of everything, I would think initially the easiest way to get noticed is by having a particular niche. I am really good at this. This is what gets your attention. And then when you get in, you just do a little bit of everything. Is it still worth trying to build out a niche to get noticed? Or is it better to try to wear a bunch of different hats as you're trying to build your portfolio?
I don't know that there's a right or wrong answer. I think both can work. It's just situational, right? I tell people the best way to get in is through the G League, through the league office, like some unique ways that people don't think about. I want to work in the NBA, right? That's where all the glory is and where all the excitement happens. But if I can get in with the G, then I get to try a few different roles because the staff's smaller. If I can get in with the league office, then I get to meet people from every team instead of just people from one team. So I think both ways are possible, but it's all about who you know and probably more importantly, who is willing to speak on your behalf. Something you learn really early on in this industry is that your promotions and your accelerations and your career advancement depends on how well your bosses think you do your job, and that might help you get elsewhere. A lot of the times it doesn't happen internally. Some of these things, there's a ceiling. There's people aren't going anywhere. These are amazing jobs. But if you can do a good job and your boss thinks highly enough of you, if something else is open in there, and like, oh yeah, we got to get him there. He can do that job and let's help him get promoted. that's the way to do it. That's kind of the things that happen. So when we look at people coming in at the entry level, it's like, who can speak for your work? Because we've never worked with you. But if you got college coach X speaking on your behalf because you were a grad assistant there, or you have this person in the G speaking on your behalf, or in the W, that carries a ton of weight and helps us kind of be at ease with taking somebody into this high confidential, high paced society that we're all in.
To add to it, I always said it's always about who knows you. Like to what Matt said, like, because you don't know who has seen what you've done. You don't know what you're doing. And there's plenty of times I've seen people like, hey, like, I understand you're at this point right now, but like they're watching your work ethic. And like, you know what I mean? It's cool to network, but like, we got a game in 30 minutes. You should probably, you know what I mean? You should probably come over here, our side, do your job a little bit.
Very true. Very, very true. It's a balance. It's a fine balance. And there's a lot of luck in it.
I got you. I want to touch on the G League thing in a little bit. But first, as you mentioned, you played basketball, played in high school, played some college. How did your experiences as a player kind of shape your journey into front office work? And I guess what were some of your challenges in kind of shifting roles on that front?
Yeah, best thing that probably happened for me was, so I got redshirted. I went D3. I got redshirted my first year. And enough of the people on the team that I was around in the offseason spoke on my behalf, similar to what we were just talking about, of, hey, this dude is working his butt off. He hasn't missed a single conditioning session. He's at every open gym, blah, 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 right? And they said, can we keep him around in some sort of capacity? So I was redshirted, but I almost became like a student assistant, a student manager at that time. And then the next year, they asked me, hey, do you want to continue going on this path, or do you want to try to play again? And I said, well, if this is the only opportunity I'm ever going to get to play, you know, during college, because once this is done, this is done. So I want to try to play. And I did, made the team the next year, and they voted me team captain. So I'm a sophomore after getting redshirted. I might have played that sophomore year. I'm serious, guys. I might have scored 6 points or something. Like, I might have played a total of 20 minutes on the season, but I was a team captain. So I got the experience of how do you lead a group from a different position where you're not, you know, the authority. You're not the best player, which is easy to listen to the best player, right? It's easy to listen to the most talented guy. It's easy to listen to the guy with the most experience, the coolest guy, whatever it was. I was none of those. But how can I get a group all rowing in the same direction, all with different backgrounds from all different places across the world, and get some sort of continuity between them and cohesion, and hey, let's push forward to, we're all doing this together and we're all trying to do it for the good of the group. And I think that what I learned in those years when I was team captain of my college team, you know, I brought that experience to a front office of not just how to motivate, but how to listen, how to understand people, how to take time to really get to learn what makes people tick, what motivates them, how best you can communicate with them. You know, what people's love language is when it comes to basketball, like all those things are super important. So those lessons as a player really helped me. And I was seeing it from a unique perspective because I was playing, but I wasn't playing, you know what I mean? And so it was a cool perspective for me to get to be a part of. So I was very thankful for those coaches, for those players, for believing in me like that.
How long did it take to kind of develop that voice? Because I would imagine that isn't an easy thing to do.
Yeah, it's a fine line, right? It has to come organically. You can't force it. And I think, I don't know. That's a great question. I've never sat back and really thought about it. It's definitely something that's developed, and my confidence level probably developed more over time. I think as a young person, I was probably shooting from the hip too much. And maybe I was trying to prove that I knew more than I did early on. And it took time to be able to relax and take a step back and be like, okay, I know what I'm doing, but I need to be patient in this situation and I need to listen more. It definitely took time and I'm still learning. I'm nowhere close to where I want to be, but luckily I'm working for some great people, and I've got to work with some great people in the past that have those skills, and I'm constantly observing them to try to see how I can get better at doing it my way.
I'll add a question. How on the journey did you balance, like, okay, I'm getting it, I'm getting there, the confidence is coming, but also the reality of, hey, ups and downs, highs and lows, are we going to get there? Are we going to do that? How did you battle the confidence with the doubt or the reality of the scenario? Because it's a very intense deal, and you can feel really good one day, and then the next day, hey, here's self-doubt knocking at your door about a whole bunch of different things, and it's you can't really express that. Because, like, you go to talk to your friends, like, hey, you work in the NBA, you're good. I'm like, hey, kind of. I'm also stressed out. It's like, hey, you got tickets? No? Okay. All right.
Hey, you're right. There's a lot of that. You're spot on. And something that I think we all deal with, at least at a certain level, if we're honest with ourselves and if we're being honest with other people, is there is some imposter syndrome with this stuff. Like, we are operating at the highest level of basketball of it. So if you look at it as I'm the 0.00000001% of people that get to do this job in the world, and it's such a sought after profession, and tons of people would want to do it. And there's definitely times where you have tough days and you go home and you're like, man, did I do that right? Am I good enough to be here? You know, you definitely think that. And I think the more you are around the right people that instill confidence in you and make you feel like, you know, there's some affirmation for, hey, try new things. That might not work, but you should definitely try it. And if it doesn't work, then we try again some a different way. But if you have the confidence of the people that you work with, it means the world. And I can speak for that. There's definitely times where I've had it. There's times where I haven't had it. This group in Dallas, off the charts. I've never felt this confident in myself. And that's not because of me. That's because of the people that I work with and how good they are, but also how well they've done instilling that confidence in me. And it's my job to pass that on to the other people that I work with and the people that I help manage and my coworkers and so on and so forth.
Got you. Just to bounce off of what Steve said and just kind of him referencing how intense of a deal it can be to work in the league in any capacity. Are you ever able to step away? Are you able to, okay, I have to turn the basketball brain off for a weekend and decompress and reload so I can really do this?
Or that's is what, it just that's what August is for?
Steve's right. You know, I remember being on the scouting trail. I'll tell you guys a little story to answer that question. Being on the scouting trail and coming to Dallas, which was nice. Every time I got to come home when I was in Brooklyn was great. And I had an SMU game. I had a Mavs game. I had maybe Texas Legends games. Like, I had 3 games in 4 nights or something like that. And my high school, one of my high school best friend's son was in middle school. He was like, hey, blah, 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 is playing at, you know, 2 o'clock on this day. Come see him. You're in town. So I go to his game and I'm sitting there and I'm in the middle of scouting 3 games in 4 nights. And I'm sitting there in the stands. This is a middle school game. And I'm like, oh man, come on. You got to get open. You got to work harder. Come on, pick up full court. What are you doing? And I'm getting mad. I'm like, do you not see the skip pass to the corner? Like, what are we doing here? What are we teaching these kids? And I remember my girlfriend at the time, she's like, will you calm the down? Just relax. And I'm like, you know, it's hard to turn it off. It is hard. I've gotten better over the years. I've definitely gotten better over the years, but it's so innate in you. And it's we live and breathe it. It is really hard to enjoy it. And I will say, at the end of my tenure, and you guys will really appreciate this, at the end of my tenure with the Nets, I became really close with Jonathan Kolb, who's the GM of the Liberty. Mm-hmm. So I'm running the Long Island Nets. I'm also running some scouting stuff for the Brooklyn Nets. And then he's there and we're all in the same area, in the same facility. And he was gracious with me and was just awesome individual. And they were still growing the program and they were new. So I was spending time at his practices, spending time going to the Liberty games. So that's still my team. I know I'm in Dallas now, and I know you guys might think I'm a homer because they're in first place. I know they had a tough game last night, but I still follow them. And I love when you guys talk about the W, but being able to go to their games and watch them play and listen to Jonathan talk about the team and take a step back from my role and my profession, just listen to him go through it on his end, was really helpful to me. It was really helpful to me to try to like understand it and approach it from a different angle and a different perspective. So it's hard to turn off, guys. It really is. But that's why I watch football and other things that I know a lot less about.
Oh, man, I relate to that portion. Like, Steve laughs at me all the time. Well, or like the basketball brain just kind of pokes out with video game stuff. It's like, dog, you don't have to do that. Or we're watching games and they have, you know, halftime entertainment is some form of basketball. And I'm just like, what is this? What we got going on here? Steve's like, bro, it's.
Yeah, you're like, where's Red Panda? We don't want to watch this. Give me Red Panda.
But no, it's because I went through that. You know what I mean? When you, as of in the video room, you are looking at basketball in a completely different way. That doesn't make any sense to a whole lot of people because you're looking for 98 different things. What's the play call? What's that hand signal? What are they running?
Yeah.
Was that an act? Let me run that back. Did they run a screen? Did they slip? Did they do that on purpose? What did we do? Is that a good defense? Your mind is going a million miles an hour, and that's just not meant for like consumption with another person near you. So I always say you kind of watch it in different steps, different ways. Like if you watch it from a scouting perspective, it's a little bit more relaxed, but now you're locked in on one person or one team. You know what I mean? You're trying to see, okay, what's his footwork like going like? Is he going left? Is he going right? Is he going to do a pull-up? And then your brain can just roll on and on. And so for me, I had to develop over my time, okay, you've done the work, stop. Stop. Because I'll just keep watching. I'll just keep watching the Detroit Pistons. It's like you've already watched five games. You're ready. You're not getting any more ready. But the perfectionism gets you. It's like, nah, I got to get it. I got to see it. I got to see it. There's something else. There's something I'm missing. And if I don't get this, then when we play in the fourth quarter and Stan Van Gundy tries to put Brook Lopez in pick and roll 98 million times, I'm going to get yelled at. I can't have that. But then you realize I can't control it anyways. So, hey, they're going to attack you in the fourth. We're going to be all right. You know, it just kind of, you have this internal conversation that's really fascinating at times, but also a little gross when it's like, hey, man, you got to just ease it on down, buddy.
It's so accurate. It's so accurate. And, you know, in the summertime, Steve, I think that's what's really interesting about our professions is you and I work together. Our jobs were different, but we might watch the same game and we're looking at completely different things. And that's why I always loved popping down in the video room. I still do it now. I'll just go sit in the chair in there and like, you know, what'd you guys see last night? Or did you catch such and such game? And you're right. I'm watching it for, hey, who's this free agent we might be looking at? Can we sign this guy? You're watching it X's nose wise. And I'm trying to blend the two. And then we get into the summertime around the draft. And I'm like, hey, Steve, can you watch this guy? Does he fit our system? And I think that's the most unique aspect of the NBA is when you can get a group. It's what I've termed now like organizational unity. When you can get a group that's looking at things in the same way from all these different perspectives, then you're really operating at a high level. So if I know exactly what the coaching staff wants out of their players because I've studied it enough, because I've spent enough time with the coaches, because I've been in those meetings, because I've watched film with them, et cetera, oh, they like this type of player, blah, 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 this type of player. Great. Now I know how to do my job better. And too often in the NBA, the changes happen so quickly to staffs that you don't get to do it. And we suffered from it with the Nets. Because it was every 2 years, there was a new head coach, there was a new system, there was a new way of doing it, there was a new player development style, there was everything was new. So a guy that the scouting group loved and thought fit Coach X's style, well, he's playing for Coach Y now, and we got to trade him because he's DMPing, and we just wasted the 15th pick on him, whatever it was. So it was like the continuity and the sustainability of it. Really helps, but being able to get all the different pieces together who are watching the game from all the different areas is really, really helpful.
To add to that, I always made the analogy at the front office that they are putting things in the pantry. It is our job to try and make this meal. Sometimes they will tell us what meal we need to make, but these are the ingredients we got. And so sometimes, you know, hey, we can really cook a mean steak. So the front office will go get you everything you need for it. sometimes it's like, hey, we couldn't get everything for that, but you can move up a mean burger. I think it's going to be just fine. It's like, hey, you know what? I think we can make it work. So I think that's always been the most fun part. I always enjoyed because, as Matt said, you kind of have different lenses on things, but you have an understanding. Okay, this is what they're looking for, or this is why they did this with this player. So maybe if we are able to now turn that into this, yeah, maybe it's we're questioning the shooting or we're questioning this, but okay, defense is there. So if we have that, we can now build some lineups to enhance that person. And, you know, it's always best when you have that synergy. And it's like, okay, now you can get magic out of someone that you didn't necessarily expect. And that's because you have that understanding that, yeah, we think he can be a 3-and-D guy. I think there's enough minutes behind your starter. Okay, cool. Then it happens. And it's like, oh, sweet. This worked. And then sometimes it doesn't work. You know what I mean? It's like, hey, we're a drop team. And he can't play drop. Well, you know, it gets yeah, kind of tricky because your team is your team and your team is different. Like, you have times where you know, okay, from a coaching perspective, this center is really good at this coverage. Unfortunately, we don't have any of the guards and wings that can get over screens to make that work. So how do we kind of get the best of both worlds so that we look the best we can? Like, those kind of conversations people don't see. They're just like, hey, why are they doing that? That's bad. It's like, well, yeah, but we're trying. We're trying.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly. And that's communication and time, right? And like, I can speak for this group in Dallas, like Nico Harrison, Michael Finley, Jason Kidd, Sean Sweeney, like, they couldn't be more on the same page. And you've probably seen that from some of the moves that we've done over the last 2 years since I've been there, since I've gotten to be a part of this and got to see them all work. But they, I think because they've all operated at such a high level and been in this thing for so long in different types of roles, that they can all come together, speak the same language. We know what Coach Kidd and Coach Sweeney want in their players. They're very explicit of, this guy fits, this guy doesn't fit. Okay, cool. Let us go try to get some of the guys that fit. Doesn't make sense banging our head for no reason. Even if we like player X better, you guys are like, yeah, but we're not really sold on them. Okay, well, we're not going to try to force that issue. Let us go get guys that make sense. So let's have the communication on it. And then vice versa. Hey, we really think this guy fits. You haven't spent a ton of time watching him. Watch a little bit more of him. He wasn't on your list, but let's dive deeper. Let's all sit down and watch together. This is why he fits us. And we think he could be the perfect guy to replace player X. So all that's communication. And when you believe in each other and that you're all kind of doing it together, that's when it's beautiful. That's when you really have that synergy.
I'll ask this off that, and it's not necessarily because we've talked about the synergy, but have you felt a shift over like the last 8-10 years as far as teams? This is our identity. This is who we are. This is what we can now build towards. And then once you find it, you know you have it. Has that shifted over the while, or has it just kind of always been, we're searching for this, we have to find it?
I think it's easier when you have a superstar. You know, it's, we got Luka and Kai, pretty easy. We know how we're going to play, right? So let's go find those pieces. It's easier when you're doing that than when you're at the infancy stage and you're still trying to experiment and figure out what your identity is. And at that time, it might be one thing for half the year and another thing for another half. And until you figure out where that kind of lies, your job is harder. Doesn't mean you can't do it, but it is more difficult. But there is power in being able to adapt as well. And you guys know it. People say it all the time. Like, once you get to the playoffs, every series is a different beast, and you got to have optionality. You have to be able to play a certain amount of different ways to be able to have sustainable success in this thing. So even if your, you know, fastball is this, that's your first pitch, but you got to be able to throw the curve. You got to be able to have the changeup. You got to be able to do these other things to give people different looks, even if your base coverage is A. So, Steve, I think it's become more commonplace as we've gotten more patient. Owners have gotten a little more patient. People have a little more time to build, which is a good thing in my mind, and is helpful for all of us to try to have success. if you look at the most successful franchises on a consistent basis, you'd probably say over the last 20 years, San Antonio, Miami. Well, what makes them successful? They have a lot of continuity. They have a lot of, you know, sustainability between the front offices, all the same people. The people, you know, leave and come in different spots, but the coaching staff's mostly the same, at least at the high end. So you're operating, you know exactly what the other person wants and how they want to run their thing. And even if the style and the system changes a little bit, which both places have, right, you still, that communication is there because that trust is built there.
Got you. Just the, I guess, related to what Steve asked you, as you've worn a lot of different hats, again, going from player to front office and operating a lot of different roles, how has your personal basketball philosophy evolved? Are there types of players that you value more now than you did back when you were playing or early in your like Nets tenure? Or like, how has that kind of evolved as you've grown?
You know what? I think if I went back to early draft room Matt in my, you know, first, second, third, fourth years, where I'm just a fly on the wall listening, and then when I finally get to speak and finally get to form an opinion, there's probably some guys I liked back then that I was like, man, why did I like that guy? You know, I liked all the small guards. Well, why, Matt? Because you were a small guard? Like, this makes no sense. You're not fit with the team. Like, so I think I've definitely evolved in that way. And I think I've become more patient that, that the team has to take the personality of the head coach and of the best player and then be built out from there. So yeah, are there certain things that I like? Yeah. Of course, toughness, grittiness, you know, things like that, that you have to have on a team to win. But it doesn't mean every guy on the team has to have that. But the people with the right personalities and the people at the right positions have to have that. So you start breaking it down. Size per position is always something that everyone talks about now is important to give you optionality in the different ways to play. Of course, athleticism, you know, character and IQ. Probably the two things that get overrated the most that are super important, especially to play for some of these coaches with the schemes that we're throwing out nowadays. Coach Sweeney on our staff is a defensive mastermind, and the things that he asks guys to do are not easy. And unless you have years within the system, or unless you're a really intuitive player or smart player, it's hard to pick up some of those concepts. So there are certain players that we just can't have on our team because it's not going to work regardless. So I think you start to figure those things out over time. But I don't know. I don't know that I have one. You know, my easy answer is, yeah, just play like Boston plays. Okay, great. Yeah, sure. Yeah, go get all those guys and put them on the same roster. And yeah, great. Okay, easy. But obviously, it's a lot harder than that. It's such a copycat league, as people say, and everyone was trying to do the Golden State thing for a while, and now everyone will try to do what Boston did. And there's different ways to do it, as you can see with the way Denver played and the way that we played and making it all the way to the finals. And it'll be interesting to see how this thing progresses, as there's so many good teams now.
I guess a question for both of you, and hopefully this isn't a bad question, but like, as I'm thinking through like the coach's lens in particular, and that you said early on, like you felt like you had the desire for coaching at a younger age than most. I guess, how important is it to have like a core philosophy or a core belief? Because you spoke to like, if you're working with a staff, you want to be adaptable, you want to be versatile, you want to be able to see things through different lens. Is it important to still have, well, I believe these are the things that win. And there are different ways to approach this, but I at least have this. If I am more of an X's old person, this is still what I want to be able to do.
I'll go first. I think it's important, but I do think you have to be flexible. Mm-hmm. You need to have your core belief, like, okay, this is how I think we win. But you also have to realize that you need to amend it if you have a different roster, if you have, you don't have X, Y, and Z that makes that work. You know, if it's like, okay, we got to be a strong defensive team. Well, hey, we don't necessarily have the defenders right this second. So while, yes, we need to hammer that home, that might not be our bread and butter this year. We have to be able to still find a way to win. So can we get defense to this level and then maximize the rest of what we got? Because like, I feel like you don't want to come in and not have your core principles, and then you're just trying to flailing and you're trying to change things all the time because it doesn't happen. But for me, a lot of times, you know, the summertime, you have a bunch of meetings, you have philosophy, you have things you want to try out in preseason training camp, and you're excited to do it. And you go out there in training camp, and day three, hey, not sure this is going to work. We got to pivot. Hey, you go out there in the preseason. Shoot, we was in Brooklyn. We lost to, what was it, Fenerbahce? It was, that was a rough day, buddy. Look, we lost to Fenerbahce. And it was like, all right, man, I don't know if we can run this with this team. Like, I think we need to pivot. Like, we got to change. So, you know, we got to change stuff very quickly. We have literally about 10 days before, you know what I mean? Like, so you have your core belief and philosophy, but you are constantly trying to evolve and tweak and change it to get the most out of your group. If you don't work and understand who your players are, you're not going to get the most out of them. If you don't get the most out of them, then what have you truly accomplished? You know?
Yeah, I think Steve hit it on the head for me. That's how we have to look at it, I think, to be successful. Like, yeah, you're going to have your core principles, but your core principles might not be even X and O's related. They might be personality based. They might be like your intangible base. I need this type of people on my team because I relate to them, or they relate to the city, or we relate to the front office altogether. But yeah, you got to be able to evolve and adapt. I think it works. Like at the college level, I think it's way more important than at the NBA level, because you can go out there and recruit certain type of players to fit your system, right? You want to run the, you know, that press that Shaka used to run at VCU and have 15 players play every game. Cool. You can go out and get the guy that can do that. You know, you get a certain NBA team that doesn't have that ability. It's like, okay, I got to change my system. I got to play a little different. I got to be able to adapt. But the biggest thing, all of it, to Steve's point, it comes back to communication. You got to, as long as everybody's on the same page and willing to change and willing to try new things, you're going to have a shot.
Got you. I guess going back to more of the personnel career, once you joined the Nets, or even when you got to Long Island, what were some of the, I guess, what were your expectations of what it meant to work in the league? What were those expectations head again? Or what were some of the things that you learned? Like, oh, this is not what I thought it was going to be, either positive or negative.
Well, my first job. So after my internship ends, I'll give you a little story. My first job, Bobby Marks calls me in. He's like, hey, got this job for you. We're going to offer you a full-time position. And I'm on top of the world, right? And he says, okay, we need you to do this. I'm going to need your help a little bit with some administrative stuff, the salary cap books. I'm going to need your help a little bit with getting the scout credentials. And then we're going to need you to be the equipment manager as well. And I'm like, okay, cool. And he's like, do you want to know how much he gets paid? I'm not really. Does it have health insurance? It doesn't matter. I'm saying yes, right? It doesn't matter. But to that aspect is, I didn't know, and you really don't know how other teams operate either, right? You're only in a bubble for a little while. And we like to use the phrase, because things go bad all the time, do not underestimate how infinitely more effed up another team is too. You just always think, you know, you're dealing with your own problems, but everyone's got their own issues. But for us, we didn't spend money. So we were at the Prudential Center playing these games before we moved to Brooklyn. And we had one dryer, so I'm one working dryer. So I'm the equipment manager. And if we played two games in three nights, I slept at the arena for 3 days. I didn't have a choice, because you're washing 15 loads of laundry. And I'm like, this is how an NBA team operates? Like, we had two dryers in college. So I think some of those aspects were a little funky. And I think the players feel that a little bit too. If some of these guys went to Duke or Arizona or Kentucky, the food that they were getting, the planes that they were flying on, and the experiences and the community that they had around them was a lot different than coming into the NBA and then getting, okay, hey, you're here now. And you think because you're getting a paycheck that it's all going to be glorious and glamorous. And there was some teams, not all teams, but some teams were taking those shortcuts. But my first coming to the NBA moment, besides the dryers and the hiccups there, where we're flying, and I can't remember who we were playing. It's preseason of my first year. I got the job. I'm 22 maybe, and I'm used to staying in, you know, Best Western hotels with four people to twin rooms. And we get out at the hotel in preseason. We're playing Boston or somebody, and we're staying at a Ritz-Carlton. And I have my own room. And I'm like, well, this seems like a huge waste. What are we doing here? But that's just the way it goes. And one of the assistant coaches at the time, he's like, a pretty big change, huh? You know, first trip, you're staying at a Ritz-Carlton or Four Seasons or whatever it was, 5-star hotel is a little different than Division III. So just the amount of money and the amount of food that's around and the different things that you start to pick up over time. I don't even think I answered your question. I took you on a long-winded round about my start in the league. But there's people on the outside that I think would be shocked about some of the things that happened in the NBA, both good and bad. There's a lot of amazing things, and there's a lot of incredible people that you get to meet and pretty cool stuff you get to be a part of.
There are just moments where you have to figure it out. I'll put it that way. I distinctly remember when I was in Memphis, walking around the streets of San Francisco with a massive projector screen because I had to go get a new one because the other one broke. And so I had to go to Office Depot and find a way to get a projector. And so I walked there, and then I was like, oh yeah, I have to walk back. So I'm just walking the streets, this big old projector in my hands. Like, oh, well, this might not have been the best idea, but we figured it out. Oklahoma City, I had to, like, the printer at the hotel was broken, so I had to go find somewhere to print things. And so I'm just walking around with a box full of scouting reports because I had to, you have to do the job. Like, you just, there are things you just have to do. Like, Brooklyn was pretty good. I did not know how much stuff we had when I went to Brooklyn. We had a lot of stuff. I was like, dang, there's a lot for me to manage. You know what's funny? The titles.
Go ahead, Steve.
I was just thinking about it, right? So I went to Brooklyn and I was the video coordinator, the head video coordinator, but my title was manager of video operations. I didn't know what that meant, but it sounded cool. So I was like, this is a cool business card. And Matt, weren't you senior director of basketball operations?
Oh man. It was like every 2 years they put a dot in there in some different capacity. Like, now you had a space in between words, or they put a new senior in something, or switched one thing around, and the of was in a different spot. Yeah, I don't know. None of it, once you're in it, you realize none of it really means anything. But it was awesome. Awesome times. But those times, Steve, that you described, like that's the fun part of the job for me, is the problem solving on the fly. And there's so many aspects, even now, even with tons of money flying around the league and everything else that these franchises are worth so much money, there's still a lot of, okay, how do we solve this problem efficiently and effectively? And the right answer might be walking to the store to print something out or to go pick up that, the projector.
Yeah, problem solving and time management. That's keys to life.
No doubt. Tell me
about it. I guess just bouncing off of the problem aspect portion, I want to go right back to philosophy of that's cool. As a former player, now assistant general manager, and you have seen the rise of analytics in the NBA and across basketball in general. But I guess in general, what is your relationship with analytics? Like, how have you had to adjust, like, how you felt about it? Like, what has the application been like for you, if you could get into that? But what has that journey been like for you?
It's been incredible. It's an area that I think I tried to explore even when I was in college, but didn't fully understand what I was doing. Trying to create different ways to show value of how guys were playing outside of the normal box score. And then obviously there's people a lot smarter than me. And once you get to the NBA, when I started, we didn't have anyone working in analytics. And then about halfway through my tenure with the Nets, we started hiring people. And then by the time I left, there's 7-8 person department. And I think it's incredible. It's such a crucial part of the decision-making of front offices. And now, helping coaching staffs as well, kind of analyze different play schemes and rotations and coverages and things like that. So it's a big piece. What I would say is the most difficult part for me to wrap my head around is you have to have the right people in that space that can give you the information in a digestible manner, but also give it to you without making it feel like this is an exact science and this is the whole truth. And part of that's on the decision maker. You know, you got to be able to cipher through everything and digest that and make the best decision. But, you know, you always have to be cautious that you aren't predicting for yesterday, that you're predicting for the future. And things change. And for instance, I'll give you one small example. We had a model in Brooklyn that was incredible, in a database that was out of this world that we were using. And you know, you're basing discussions and player values and different things off this. It's at least part of the discussion, as it should be. And then one day you get an email and it's like, hey, we made some tweaks to the program. So that guy that we had at 14 million, we figured out, yeah, it looks like he's worth 9 million. And you're like, well, dang, that's a big difference. And okay, if that tweak's there, I'm sure there's some other tweaks, and that's okay. And this should be good. It's evolving. You've got to constantly make it better. Just like my scouting opinion on a guy that I saw in November, and I might say he's terrible, changes by the time the draft comes. That evolves. But if I'm presenting my scouting report in November and saying this is the absolute truth, I'm 100% sure on this because I have XYZ to back it up, then I'm doing us a disservice. So I always think the decision makers have to be conscientious of forming their own opinion and not believing that any one aspect of it is the end all be all, and taking it all into context and making the best decision. But without analytics, we would not be surviving. The game wouldn't be progressing to where it is today. And there are some super talented people that I've been able to work with, both in Brooklyn and now in Dallas, who are really pushing to a new frontier with that.
Ooh, before you go, Nikias, because I know that was music to your ears, I do have a question to bounce off of what Matt said. How did you develop that? Because there's something you said when it came to scouting where, okay, I saw this in November, but this is not the absolute truth. This is not going to be the end game. How do you balance seeing that, having that opinion, but not necessarily saying this is all this player is? So I feel like sometimes in this day and age, it gets lost in translation sometimes. You see a player do this, and it's like, well, they can't do that, or this number says that, so that's all they are, and they just kind of leave it, and then they're surprised when they have success either in a different spot or later in the year. How did you develop that, though? Because it is easy. When you watch a certain player, a certain team, you can kind of get into a little bit of a loop, like, okay, well, they can't do this. And it's like, well, maybe they can. You know, how did you kind of develop that eye? Because I know it took me a little bit to kind of understand this isn't the full story. I need to, like, this is what they are right now, but this is what they could be.
I think just experience, right? You see yourself, you're wrong before, and you, if you really take a step back and do some self-reflection, okay, why was I wrong on that guy? That guy was way more successful than I thought he would be. What could it be? And you try to find the commonalities of why that could be. There is in the scouting world, we're guilty of it. There's a fundamental attribution error for sure, to where we scout and we often commit this error without thinking of or giving credence to the situation or the context. And there's multiple examples every year of a guy who looks terrible in one place and gets traded somewhere else and looks a lot better, or goes to a college program and averages 5 points because they run a certain style of offense and he never touches the ball, and then goes to the NBA and looks like a totally different guy. So I think being able to understand the context and the situation matters so much. And it all boils down to the same thing to me, that you each piece holds merit in what it is. My evaluation of a guy in November does hold some merit, but it could be looked at as a positive. He was terrible in November. Look how much better he got by the end of the year. It shouldn't be, I saw him in November, he's out of here, we don't ever want to look at him again. That's why one of the main things we say often is, do you do the work to justify having an opinion? And that doesn't mean I saw the guy once. If you do the work, you're watching a ton of film, you saw him play 15 games, you really spent time diving into the team aspect of it. And a lot of that, I got to go to the coaches for, hey, can you watch this team play a little bit? Like, I can't figure out why they're using this guy like this. I feel like he could be better if he was in our situation, you know, asking the right questions and trying to get a feel for that. But it takes time, and it takes admitting that you're wrong and admitting that you screwed up on some guys, and then having some self-reflection of how do I get better? because I don't want to let the team down. I don't want to let my bosses down. How do I get better at my job so I'm giving quality information based on everything that I have?
I like that. And this is how you know Steve and I have done the podcast for a very long time, because my question to you was going to be just how long do you hold on to your priors when it comes to watching a team or watching a player? I would imagine there is a balance between, you know, you want to be adaptable, you want to be able to see more, change your opinion stuff, but you also want to go into a room saying, I have this opinion at the very least. Even if it isn't the end all be all, I do trust what I've seen.
Yep. Yep. And I think there's a way to say it, right? This is what I see right now. This is what I think that would look like with us. I don't trust it. I don't trust the habits. I don't trust the personality. I don't trust the game, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. It could get there, but I don't trust it. So would I recommend it? No, it's a risk. You want to do it? Let's take the chance. But there's a risk here. Or I believe in who this person is as a person. I've done my homework. I've done enough. I've seen enough. I've seen them in different contexts. I think there's more there. Let's make a run at it. And here's why. But at the end of the day, as Steve knows, all of our jobs, unless you're the GM or the head coach, is we make suggestions. My job is to make suggestions, right? My job is to take as much out of my boss's way in terms of problem solving so it never gets to them. And then when it comes to roster building and decision making, I'm going to make some suggestions, and hopefully they're educated suggestions. I don't want to be shooting from the hip, but at the end of the day, the boss got to make that call. And it takes really, really secure people in their position to be able to be like, you know what? I'm rocking with that. I might not agree with it, but if you feel that strongly about it, let's do it. And that's hard to do, but it happens. It happens all over the place. And I think we all learn from those situations as well.
You learn from your losses, but you also learn to have the confidence to keep saying your piece. Because even if something doesn't land right away, someone might come to you 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later. Hey, what do you think of this? Or, hey, I've been thinking about this. We should do this. You just have to kind of believe in it. But like Matt said, if you do the work, it becomes a lot easier to A, just do it naturally, and B, okay with your mistakes. Because, you know, the work is the work. You're still going to do the work and keep doing it. But people will respect that you put that work in, even if they disagree, or even if you might not be 100% right, they'll respect where it came from. So it's just about doing it over and over and over again. I think that's, for me, tying it back to earlier, that's what helped me kind of avoid the perfectionism, because I knew, okay, no, I know what I'm talking about, and they know what I know what I'm talking about. So just keep doing it. And then once you have that trust and belief, you just kind of keep going from there.
Got you. As related to that, for the both of you, honestly, if you're watching a player, either scouting purposes for the draft or scouting potential free agent, whatever the case may be, how many games does it normally take you of a player before you feel confident in, okay, this is what they can do, this is what I think they might be able to do in the future, et cetera?
A lot for me. I like to have a nice base, at least, that I can build on, or at least I've seen a pattern. Like, I need to see a pattern. Or I need to see you against different types of opponents or against different coverages. If I feel like once I've seen you, I don't want to say against everything, but once I've seen you handle a variety of situations, I feel pretty comfortable about my thoughts on it. So I've built up a database over it. I don't want to watch you play Team X and they played zone and okay, cool, but that's not necessarily going to be you. You know, how do you deal with different scenarios, different coverages? How do you defend different players? Like, I just want to be able to feel comfortable enough having seen you go through enough. So that might, for some guys, might take 10, might be 15, might be 20, might be 5, you know, depending on who you are and who you played and what. Oh, nope, I see it. You've done this every single time I've seen you. You know what I mean? You're going to keep watching, but it's just how long can I work to build and understand what that team is? Like, for me, I've always said, like, with teams, first half of the season, okay, I'm trying to figure out who you are. What do you do? What do you do well? When do you struggle? What happens when you struggle? How do you face this team? Do you play it up? Do you rise up? What are you trying to do? And then once I have a pretty firm grasp on that, okay, I know who you are. You know what I mean? I know you're going to do this, and that. I know you're doing this defensively. You struggle because of that. Oh, I know who you are. But that earlier in the season, I am always looking towards the team that have new additions. Because, okay, are you gelling? What does this look like? Who are you? Now, once I build that base, like, Miami's Miami. I'll just use an example. I don't necessarily, like, I'm going to watch Miami early, but they're not necessarily going to be at the front of my list because I know Miami's Miami. They're going to be who they are. A team that's newer, I'm, okay, I need to understand. Like OKC last year. Okay, what are y'all doing? Why is this working so well? Oh, you guys just drive the basketball all the time. That's okay. I get it. And then you just kind of go from there. Like, that's just kind of how my brain works.
I think you guys are unique in that aspect as well. You know, listening to your podcast, following you guys on Twitter, seeing all the stuff that you tweet in the videos, how much basketball you watch is awesome. And I don't think we do enough of that, even in the profession. I don't think any of us do enough or probably do as much as we should. You never want to have a calcified view on a player and just sit firm and just be stuck with that. It's going to evolve over time. But again, did you do the work, enough work to have an opinion? And something Steve said hit home for me, because I think another aspect of it is, do you understand the context enough? And a lot of this comes into college scouting, but that is a huge, huge aspect of understanding these players. What are they being asked to do? Easier in the NBA, right? As you pointed out, you know how Miami's going to play. You know Oklahoma City's defensive coverages, et cetera, et cetera. But what is being expected of this person? And are they doing what is expected of them? Even if it looks funky to you and you're like, man, I don't know. Can he really keep the ball in front? Oh, maybe he's being asked to funnel the ball to the big, like, et cetera. So understanding the context in the coverages helps as well. But to do that, you have to watch a ton of film. You have to see it live. You have to feel it. All those things come into play.
It's bouncing off of that. Was there a particular area of film watching as you made your shift to, you know, being on a coaching staff? Was there a particular area in film watching that someone pointed out to you, like, hey, what about this? And that kind of informed, oh, I should probably be watching for this a little bit more.
Well, it wasn't me, Matt. I didn't do it.
No, Steve, I thought Steve's laughing like he knows the answer that or the answer that you want to hear. So I don't know that I have an answer for you. Obviously, as you get more involved and more fine-tuned into watching individual players from my end, not from a coaching end, but from a personnel end, you're watching more off-the-ball stuff that you don't catch in person as much. Mm-hmm. But that's just more from a scouting standpoint. Are they an opportunistic cutter? How do they move without the ball? Are they in the gaps defensively? You know, are they pulling over from the weak side, et cetera, et cetera. But from a coaching standpoint, I don't know. I'd pass that one to Steve.
I think for me, it was just going through meetings and going through practices and having conversations and understanding that, okay, there's a reason that some of these things are happening. There's a reason some of these things are occurring. And I need to figure out the why. Like, I always wanted to figure out the why. And then I also am stubborn, so I don't like groupthink. So if there's three people that say the same thing about a team, I now want to look and see, okay, not that you're wrong, but there's something else to it. You know, like, hey, we can't defend this action. Why can't we defend it? Okay, now I'm going to go watch and try and figure out an answer. I never loved that part of it. Even if I want to, there's more to the game. Like, I always want to think about, not cover every angle, but there's something else that we're missing here. And so let's talk about it and figure that out. And if we don't talk about it, then, you know, we're going to make mistakes. Like, I make mistakes all the time. I told the story. My first scout, Al Jefferson, you're not getting anything done against the Bobcats. And then Kemba Walker said, ha ha. And I was like, well, never again. So you just kind of learn by error. You know what I'm saying?
I got you. Like, as someone who has not worked for a team, like, the first example that comes to my mind, like, I was not honed in on when a team was starting an action until Steve pointed out, hey, we're watching games together. We're doing the watch party stuff. It's like, okay, 15 on the clock. Now they're getting into XYZ. And that that's like the first thing I'm looking at on the scorebook with team bringing the ball up. It's like, okay. I want to zoom out and see, are they setting up a stagger? Are they setting up Spain? Whatever the case may be. But now I was like, okay, is this happening with 18 on the clock? Is this happening with 14 on the clock? What's going on here? So that was the first thing I thought of. Like, I just would have never thought to keep track of that without getting that. Well, I was curious to learn from people that have done this professionally.
I got an interesting follow-up for you on that. When I was an intern in New Jersey at the time, this is 2009-10 season, Lawrence Frank was the head coach, and he got let go mid-season, and Tom Barese took over for two games, and Kiki Vandeweghe ended up coaching the rest of the way, coming from the front office. And part of my internship responsibilities was I was tracking when in the shot clock we took the shot and when the opponent took the shot. I don't know that there might have been an analytical way to do it back then, but we didn't have access to it. So piece of paper, jotting them down. So home games, okay, not bad. I can do that in home games. Then you're at the end of the game averaging, okay, on our makes, we took a shot with X amount of time on the clock, blah, blah, blah. For road games, I wasn't traveling with the team. I was an intern and I didn't have a TV. So I made a deal with, this is awesome. So I made a deal with the bar down the street from where I was staying in this place in New Jersey that I got off Craigslist, sight unseen. I'd never been in this apartment before, where I was like, hey, I got to get up there next week. I got this place. So I knew you guys would love this. So I made a deal with the bar. I went in there one day. I'm like, hey, can you guys get the Nets games? And they're like, nobody watches that. They're terrible. I'm in New Jersey, guys. It's not like, I'm like, okay. So I said, well, listen, you got 15 TVs in here. I'm going to come in here randomly on game nights when the team's on the road. Can you just put this one TV on the Nets for me? I'm broke. I got no money. I'm not going to buy anything, but I'll bring you gear. Mm. And as Steve knows, gear is currency. I said tickets and they're like, yeah, we don't care. I was like, gear, I got you. So I would just bring in, you know, some of my gear. I was like, here, you guys can have this. You guys can have this. And I sat at the same seat in a bar by myself and would track these numbers during the road games. So much so that these people became my family. But the best part of the whole story is I would turn these reports in to my boss at the time, and I had no idea where they were going. And at the end of the year, I asked one of the assistant coaches, I'm like, were those reports ever helpful? You know, I was going to do them anyway. And he was like, what reports? And I was like, the ones with the time on the game. And he goes, oh man, that was a Lawrence Frank thing. We stopped looking at that as soon as he was gone. And I was like, oh, interesting. All right. I've been doing it the full season, but I loved it. It was great. So to your point, looking at interesting things like that, like I would have never thought about that unless somebody directed me to it and told me I needed to do it. How quickly a team was getting in his action, how quickly a team was, you know, taking a shot with how much time on the shot clock or getting the ball over half court is a thing now, right? So it was an interesting anecdote on that.
Wow. That is both awesome and I'm sorry that happened. Like
It was fascinating. I loved it. It was part of who I am, you know. I miss those days, to be honest. It was great.
There we go. I guess while we're in the story zone, when did you and Steve have your first interaction? Do you remember what that was and where that was?
I'm interested to hear.
I don't. It had to be at the practice facility.
It was in the facility in old East Rutherford. Now,
East Rutherford, right?
Fun fact, I had a much larger office than I should have had in that practice facility.
Your office was nice, right there off the court. The windows, really nice.
So, yeah.
For those of you who don't know, East Rutherford, it's a swamp. It's literally built on a swamp, all this land. And our office was a former book press or book storage unit or something that got converted. And the basketball portion was nice. Steve's office was awesome. If you went to my office, it looked like we were in 1970s with like this orange carpet and green walls and like, I don't know, cubicles. It was nasty looking. The office part was horrendous, but I'm sure sometime around then, when you and the rest of the coaching staff came in the summertime that we met, I do not remember an exact moment. I don't. Do you have one?
No, I don't remember. I'm very much a locked in person. So it's like, I keep seeing him. What's up, man? I don't know. It just kind of grew from there. Like, I don't remember. Yeah.
we're in the building together. Like at that time, this might've been a little before your time, but all the younger employees, we would just share protein bars because that was the only thing that was there to eat. So you're stuck there for hours and hours and hours. And it was like, you know, there's four protein bars left. for the day until the people come tomorrow and put out new ones. Maybe if you're lucky. So you're like, all right, who's still in the building? All right, Steve's still here. Dice was back in hoop one or something. It's like, all right, cool. Let's split this up. You get one, I get one. Like, yeah, just sharing protein bars. It was interesting times. Now there's chefs cooking for, you know, seven chefs per team and industrial sized kitchens and cooking for every single member of the front office and coaching staff and support staff and players. Back in the day, sometimes the food was only for the players. Yep. It's come a long way. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe we played pickup at some point, and I just remember Steve like playing like old school Mark Jackson, like getting the ball and backing it down from, we're playing pickup like from half court and throwing passes and stuff like that. That I think that might be my first memory of Steve as a basketball player and staff pickup, and he was killing. But that might be my first memory.
The old pickup runs. Shout out to my guy Mike Jones, TCU legend. And him would just go back and forth a lot during those. And so he would, incredible scores. He'd just make pull-up after pull-up, and it was very frustrating. And for me, if my jumper wasn't going, which, depending on the day, I was just going to drive left and hit someone as hard as I could. And then if that didn't work, I was going to post up and hit someone as hard as I could. And this is the last time that I played. But man, when we played, it was, I wanted to, this is the last part of competitive me that I had, but I wanted to win every single game. And I was like, I didn't want to change teams most of the time. I wanted to be on the same team, the same people. It's like, no, we're going to beat you. And hey, Riccardi, you open, shoot that, shoot it.
It was awesome. We had a blast. We had a good time. We definitely did.
Uh-huh. Well, on the Nets, right, what was it like working with or working alongside Kevin Garnett?
Ooh. You know, I will say this. Best teammate I have ever seen. And I know that is a strange thing to say, but he was a phenomenal person and an even better teammate. Like, he cared about his teammates more than breathing, more than living. Like, amazing, amazing, amazing teammate. And I don't know that maybe we'll see somebody else like him in the future. I have no idea, but he was so unique. I'll tell you one story that stands out to me is, Steve will remember this too, is he was later in his career, so we would try to get him not to practice as much, but he's such a fiery competitor. And in East Rutherford, there was two courts that ran parallel to each other. Mm-hmm. And we'd be like, KG or Ticket, as we called him. Hey, Ticket, we got three games this week. We're practicing after the second one. Like, we don't want you to practice today. Just come in, get some treatment, relax. And of course, he's cursing everybody out and just in the way that he does. And it's, you take it because you love him. And, you know, 5 seconds later, he's going to give you a big hug. And like, he'd do anything for you too. So anyway, he's going through his thing and he's like, man, I'm practicing, you know, explicit, you know, a bunch of different words thrown in there. And, you know, like he didn't want to be seen by the other guys of, you know, coming to the end of his career, that he was taking plays off or not practicing or not going through it with them. That's how good of a teammate he was. So one day he's not supposed to practice. He comes running out of the locker room. Practice is about to start. Everyone's done their pre-practice prep, comes sprinting out, comes there, you know, breaks the huddle, whatever. We start doing, I think we were scrimmaging or doing something. And he goes on the practice court and he's playing. You guys have seen Above the Rim. I'm sure your audience has too. You remember when my man's in the park without a ball, like playing by himself? That was KG. He was mirroring the offense and the defense, whichever. If the starters were on defense, he's on defense. He's in coverage. Mm-hmm. He's playing center. He's calling things out. Screens coming left, left, left. He's calling ice, whatever. Calling stuff out, playing defense, rotating over, shot would go up. He'd turn and box an imaginary guy out, go up, get a fake rebound, ball. There's no ball, guys. he'd outlet to a ghost, sprint down to the other end, post up, then run out and set a ball screen. There's no one else on the court. He's doing this by himself. And when I tell you he would do it the entire time, it wasn't like, let me do it once and it's a joke. He would do it the entire scrimmage because he was basically like, you guys are telling me I'm not going to practice. Great. I'm just not going to do contact, but I'm practicing over here. So these guys will know I am working. It was incredible. I've never seen anything like it. Steve, you remember that?
Yes. Yes. Like, it's like, you heard about Kevin Garnett, and then once you saw the work that he put in before practice to get ready for practice, and that man that looked like he already practiced before practice, yeah. It's like, well, hey, man, this is what he does. Like, and if you weren't working, he was going to get after you, and we're going to work. Like, it was such a good thing. I'll tell my first interaction with KG. So we did like a, whatchamacallit, meeting at a hotel where it was like, hey, here's the basketball operations staff. Here's all the people that are going to be around. You should know what they do type beat. And so me and Mike go
training camp in Duke, Cameron.
I think it might've been the year before.
That year?
I think it was the year before. Sorry. It was one of those. No, in Duke, he was aware of who I was. The first time he was not aware of who I was. And so me and Mike walk up there and we're both at the time, younger buffer lads. And so I do the quick video room spiel or whatever. And all I hear is his voice go, I thought y'all was security. What you mean the video room?
No shot.
That was my introduction to Kevin Garnett. I was like, all right, cool, man. But he's a one of a kind, tremendous. Like, if you were, he was down with you and you were on his team, you were on his side, he's going to ride for you forever. If you were not, you're on the other side, it's a wrap for you. Yep. And you're going to hear about it nonstop, constantly.
No one cared more than that guy. Literally no one. I've never met anyone who cared more about the team, about winning, than him. Like, it was life or death. You know, every day mattered. He was so intense. I got one more quick one. I remember this is before Steve, but we're first year he gets there. We're on the cover of Sports Illustrated. It's you know, Pierce, KG, Darren Williams, Joe Johnson, Brooke Lopez, cover of Sports Illustrated. Oh man, this is going to be amazing. Blah, 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 blah. And we start the year like 9-20 or 9-18. I don't know, something like that, but we were bad. And we lose to a terrible Knicks team at home in Brooklyn. And everyone cleared out of the locker room and I'm there. I don't remember what I was doing, but I was there super late and I'm still like getting my stuff. And then I got to walk into the training room because there's this little locker room for our support staff in there. So I had to go get my stuff before I got to go home. No one is in the building. Like, I'm talking, this is 4 or 5 hours after the game. I see this figure in the corner, like rocking back and forth, no shirt on, towel over his head, shorts on, just in the corner. It's not pitch black in there, but it's dark, right? Like, some of the lights are already out. I'm telling you guys, everyone is gone. And I'm like, what is going on over here? So I walk over there and I'm like, ticket? And he lifts the towel up. He probably won't want me to tell this story. He is crying. Like, there are tears coming down his face. He is sitting there by himself. He is crying. He is so emotional. He's like, man, I can't eat. I can't sleep. This is terrible. We got to be better than this. And he's using a lot, you know, more colorful language than this. But it meant so much to him. He's like, and we lose the game and everybody in there talking about where they're going to eat tonight. It's a Friday night and they're going out in the city and this and that, whatever. Like, it's like they don't care that we lost. And I was like, whoa, this is crazy. This is how much it meant to him that he's sitting there 5 hours after a game rocking back and forth and was so emotional about it. Like, he couldn't leave. He was like, I can't leave. I can't go home right now. Like, I'm not in the right state of mind. So we grabbed a bottle of wine. I remember Tiny helped us out, Matt Horton. So Tiny is an infamous basketball person, or person in the basketball world, one of the nicest guys you will ever meet. He's like this 6'10", 7-foot guy that runs the visiting team locker room at Barclays Center. And he's still there. He's a tremendous, tremendous guy. And that's his second job. He's got other jobs. And I was like, Tiny, you still in the building cleaning things up? I need some help. Like, you get us a bottle of wine or something. So he went to the back and his connections was able to get. So me and Ticket are sitting here drinking a bottle of wine out of plastic cups in the locker room 5 hours after a game ends. And I'm just sitting there listening to him talk about, you know, it, I might as well not been there. It's just him talking about his what his experiences are. And I was just lucky enough to be the person that was there and got to be part of it and to see how much it meant to him. I know it's a long-winded story, guys, but I was so moved by that. And like, it made me work harder. I was like, man, I'm not doing enough. Mm-hmm. I got to do more. What can I do? And the next day I'm trying to find different things to do to like help, because we were in bad shape. And then that team got really good and had the best second half of the year in the league that year. We ended up losing to the Miami Heat in the playoffs, the LeBron Miami Heat, but we had a great run. At some point something happened and triggered, but I'll never forget that moment with him. That'll stick with me the rest of my life.
That is incredible. Like, that kind of intensity is, that's rare. I would imagine.
It's one of a kind, man.
Yeah. My favorite guy I've ever dealt with. He was incredible. Ever got to be a part of. He was leaving the facility after exit interviews, and I was waiting in the hallway. I was like, I got to get him before he leaves, because I'm never going to see this guy again, right? Like, I don't know. He's never going to answer my text, whatever. Mm-hmm. And he's leaving the building, and I'm like, Ticket, I just wanted to thank you for everything. I learned a lot from you. He gives me this big hug. And he's like, me? You learned a lot from me? I learned a lot from you, mother effer, this, that, the other, blah, blah, blah. You know, like, there's no normal Kevin Garnett stuff, but amazing person. I'm very fortunate that I got to be around him and got to be a part of part of the story.
Man, he's such an amazing dude. I only got to spend half a year with him, and I got stories. Like, he went on a back-to-back. We played at Washington. He did not play the second night of back-to-back, but he was in the back, and he was not happy. We lost by like 34 points. So he went from, hey, you want some wings, to what are we doing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But just that experience, I got to watch a whole game with Kevin Garnett. That was insane. Like, you know what I mean? Blessings, blessings. What a year that was, by the way. Sorry, it's only went to the playoffs once. Sorry, Matt. Try my best.
That is tremendous content. Well, before we head out here, Steve, did you have anything else for Matt? I think I have emptied my chest of questions.
Oh, no. I was going to talk about the last day of the season, 2015.
Ah. Yes. Yes.
The one time Steve helped the Nets make the playoffs, as we won like 9 of our last 12 games to get to 38-44. So how do we want to tell this? Because we needed to win.
I'll give you my memories, and I want to hear your memories of this too. So we trade Kevin Garnett that year for Thaddeus Young, and our team was still okay, but we were struggling. We weren't going to make the playoffs, and we go on that run at the end of the year. And my dad, middle of the season, my dad was like, "Hey, I'll come to town. Maybe I'll come catch the playoff games." My dad lives in Dallas, right? And season starts going by. I'm like, hey, you might want to come in like April. I don't know if we're gonna make it. You know, we're struggling. Like, I'm trying to be optimistic here, but I don't know if we're gonna make it. So come spend some time with me, and we'll go to some games. And it's an awesome feeling, right? I'm sure, you know, like you get to do something special for somebody in your family, or allow them a small glimpse of what your life is, and allow him to come. And he would come early with me and sit there on the sideline during warmups, and we just get to hang out. And be like, you know that guy? I'm like, yeah, I work with all these people, you know? So, so anyway, he comes to the games, the last game of the year. We have to win, but not only do we have to win, the Memphis Grizzlies have to beat the Indiana Pacers. Yep. So two things have to happen for us to make it. And our game was before them. It was before they did the thing where all the games are at the same time. Mm-hmm. So our game was before the other game. And I just remember Bojan Bogdanović going off, came off the bench, and I don't know, he had 30 or something. And he wins us the game against Orlando. So we win. And a bunch of people get out of there and leave, but there was a group of us that were like, oh, we got to watch the end of the Indiana-Memphis game. So we put it on the Players Lounge at the arena, which Players Lounge is nice, spacious. So it was a mixture, such a weird combination of people. It's like Brooke Lopez, a few of the team attendants, me, my dad. Steve, I don't think you were in that room. You might have been in the video room, and like a few other random people, right? And we're watching this game, and then Memphis wins, So we get to go to the playoffs, and I remember celebrating like we won the championship, and like I'm hugging my dad, and Brooke Lopez was like high-fiving my dad, like he thought it was the greatest day of his life. It was amazing. So that was my experience. You tell yours on that crazy day, Steve.
So it's very funny that you told your dad that, because again, I will remind folks, we were 25-38 on March 11th that year. It was not looking good at all. But so we played first, Memphis played second. I think Memphis was on ESPN or something like that. Very funny that I needed Memphis to win considering I had just left there. So I sent some texts to some people and they said, ha, good luck, bud. And I'm like, well, this is not ideal. We win our game, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm in the video room in Barclays. We turn on the Indiana-Memphis game. I send my two guys home. I'm just like, just go. After like the first quarter. And in my mind, I'm like, because I had restarted the playoff books, but I had not completed the playoff books. Because I'm a big believer in, you know, I had to be ready, but I also wasn't, you know what I mean? We weren't all the way there. I had everything I needed. I just need to put it together. So I am like, okay, I have got to get back to the facility in East Rutherford in case they win. So I make the drive back. I get to the facility. I go to my office. I turn the TV on. The only thing, I didn't listen to the game. I was listening to music. Like, I was just like, we're not going to put any bad juju. Whatever happens, happens. The only thing I hear when I turn my TV on is, all I knew is win, 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 no matter what. And I'm like, okay, they won. Sent a couple texts. Thank you, thank you. Went right to the gas station around the corner. Got six Monster, like the orange logo ones. I still remember it to this day. And I spent the entire night at the facility putting everything together for the playoff books, laying everything out. Yep, everyone came in hype, just watching people rolling in the morning. To try not to tell anyone that, hey, I've been here the entire time. Only for Coach to then do his normal spiel of, hey, none of this matters. We got to win. And I'm like, could you have done that tomorrow, Coach? Like, it's like the third time I had heard it. So I knew it was coming. But I was just like, dog, I have not slept in 24 hours. Can you? So yeah, that's amazing. That was my day.
I'm glad you survived those six Monsters. That's scary.
Look, man, I had to get it done. I had to get it done, man.
You know what's crazy though? We played okay against Atlanta.
We should have won that series,
A few of those games we played okay. It was the one versus the eighth seed, and they won 60 games that year. They had 4 or 5 All-Stars or whatever that craziness was.
I'm the old person in the cloud saying we should have won that series. There was one game in Atlanta that we definitely could have won.
Yep.
And then we didn't win it. Shout out Darren Williams. He had that game in Barclays.
Yep.
We didn't win game 5. And I was like, cool. It's all right. We'll be back. Got smoked in game 6.
Yeah.
It's just a horrible feeling. It's just like, well, I guess it's over.
It was a funky team too. Like we were starting. I love Markell Brown to death. I still talk to him, but we're starting Markell Brown. It was his first or second year. It was just an interesting team. So,
yeah, it was fun. Good times. Good times.
Good days.
We're gonna need the Patreon episode to get to some of these other stories.
Well, no, I'll share the one thing. Hey, Ricard, were you there when Bargnani got signed?
I mean, I was there, as in the building, there as. I'm sure I was.
So I ended up being the last coaching person that was there when Bargnani got signed. So I had to work Bargnani out that day. And I was just about to go home. And they pulled up and like, hey, can you work out Bargnani real quick? I was like, all right, man, I got you. Which was fine because he just made a bunch of shots. And, you know, I mean, I never mind worked out bets. They're just going to tell you what they want to do anyway, so.
But I just, he didn't want to be there anyway. He wanted to count his money and go home anyway.
So yeah, that was very funny.
How we close with Bargnani.
And then we we're in the facility in Brooklyn, but everyone still lived in New Jersey because we moved mid-season. So everyone just slept. So we finished the game at Barclays Center. Instead of trying to go home and come back the next morning, like half the staff, we just had big slumber party at the practice facility. So you'd walk through and everyone would be sleeping on the floor of their office. But the problem was all the lights were motion censored. So if anyone got up to do anything, all the lights would turn on. So there's literally, there's 12, 15 people sleeping in their office on any type of game night. And if you had to get up to go to the bathroom, you're like, man, I got to be that guy. And then all the lights in the hallway would turn on. So it was crazy. It was crazy. But amazing time.
Shout out to the facility. The facility was so nice. I got a good like month out of it. I had the nicest office too. It was like right by the court. I could just see everything. I was like, oh, this is going to be cool for somebody.
They did a really good job with that Brooklyn office.
Yeah. But yeah, you had to navigate. Yeah. Okay. When do we leave? Do we want to stay there? Don't let us have shoot around at Barclays, buddy. Well, I guess I'm here all day.
No doubt. Trying to battle that traffic. Yeah. That facility was beautiful, but I do not miss those commutes at all.
No, me neither. But yeah,
we've hit something deep.
Guys, you happy? You got all the stories you wanted? Do you want Matt to reveal any other dirt on me?
No. At least not on the podcast. You know, once I do the outro, you know. But no, in all seriousness, thank you, Matt, again for joining us. Really appreciate you giving so much of your time. Steve, thank you also for doing this with me every week. I appreciate you, big dog.
Oh, you're welcome. You feeling good, Don? All right. I'll take it. I ain't complaining. You want to keep going?
Thank you, producer Richie. Just going to thank everyone.
Hey, you guys were awesome. Just let me say thank you. Appreciate you. Humbled, honored to be here. And hopefully we get to do it again sometime during the season or something. But appreciate you guys having me on and taking me down memory lane a little bit. I really enjoyed it, but your podcast is awesome. I really enjoyed listening to it. So thank you guys. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you all for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. You can follow me on Twitter at NikiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join the Dunker Spot community on Twitter if you haven't already. Join us for our online Dunker Spot watch parties. W season still in full swing, so if you want to watch along, drop your comments in, ask some basketball questions, etc. We do that. We also have a whole lot of YouTube/wrestling/video game things happening as well. So if that is your speed, this is also your place to be. Come rock with us. The link to the room is in the podcast description. It is free to create your profile. No shenanigans. But beyond that, enjoy your weekend and we will catch y'all next week.
Bye.